This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. It is Labor Day, a time to honor working people. And today on the program, we're taking a moment out to honor teachers. They're getting a much-needed break today, a break from one of the hardest jobs out there. North Carolina is suffering right now from a shortage of teachers. The state has had to import over 1,000 teachers from foreign countries, and nearly 50% of all new teachers in North Carolina quit their jobs within 5 years. So why is it that? Is teaching just too hard? Is it the pay, the hours, the environment? What is it about teaching that makes it so difficult for the state to fill its vacancies and keep the good teachers that it has? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. If you're a teacher or ever have been a teacher, or even if you are someone who has been greatly affected by a teacher you've had, we'd love to hear from you. The number again, 1-877-962-9862. We have a few teachers with us today to talk about that, or people who've been in the teaching profession. And we're starting off right now with Barbara Chapman, who is a principal at New Hope Elementary School in Orange County. Happy Labor Day to you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Well, why did you get into teaching?
Well, I wanted to save the world. I came through school in the 60s, and I truly did want to be a part of saving the world, and I thought that was an excellent way to do it.
So what corner of the world did you start out saving?
I started out saving the children that would be labeled at risk, and which I think is probably any child. Any child is at risk of not realizing his or her potential. And I began teaching in the San Joaquin Valley of California. Had a big surprise. No one had told me there were children who came to school not speaking English. I'd grown up way in Northern California, so had some real challenges. I had no idea. I was so ignorant.
So you have, over the years, become a principal.
Yes.
And I've heard you, it's been said of you that you would not want to go back to being a teacher right now.
No, it's too hard. That's why I'm a principal. I think those people who are in the classroom should have all the support they can possibly get. And I think that that's my role as a principal. I think every resource in a school system should be directed, and every resource in education throughout the state should be devoted, directed at supporting the classroom teacher, because it's the classroom teacher that is working with the children, and this should be all about what we do for the children.
So you say that's how it should be. I take it by that, that you think that's not what is happening now?
I wouldn't say that it's not what is happening now. I think it's very easy for us to become diverted from that with pressures from outside, pressures for higher student performance. But so many of the things that we might do to improve student performance may not be in the best interest of children. So I think any action we take needs to be evaluated in terms of what it does for children.
Well, I want to get to more of that in a moment with exactly what areas you think in particular that it's counter to the interests of children. But I want to introduce right now Kenneth Dobbins, who is a freshman English teacher at West Johnson High School. Teaching is Kenneth Dobbins' second career. He used to work in the telecommunications industry, and readers of the Raleigh News and Observer may be familiar with his story. He's been writing about his teaching experiences since he began teaching 2 years ago. Kenneth Dobbins, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is your third year teaching.
That's correct.
But why did you decide to leave what you've described as a high-paying job to go into teaching?
Well, it was nothing quite so noble as Barbara's desire to save the world. But it was certainly a search for a life change, actually resulting from a car accident that was rather frightening, but in no way long-term damaging. And it just got me thinking that maybe there was more out there in terms of a career. And so I had never graduated from college. So the first step was to come to North Carolina, where my family is, go back to school and finish. And during that process, I became acquainted with the teacher certification program and some of the kinds of feelings that I could get out of that, which were really quite remarkable.
So you were in your late 30s when you decided to make this switch, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I graduated from college at 40.
Okay. Now, why did you pick teaching in particular?
Well, it started just because being in class again, I realized that a lot of the students I saw and worked with lacked skills that I thought were sort of fundamental. And so I would coach the students I was in class with when we did group work. things like that. And a professor who saw that said, you know, you ought to consider teaching. First time I went into a classroom as part of the certification program, I taught a lesson on Mark Twain to a group of seventh graders. Mm-hmm. And just that feeling, kind of the energy in the room, just got me hooked. It was really quite remarkable.
No, people have been reading your Trials and Tribulations as a new teacher at West Johnston High School for the past 2 years. Do you still get that thrill, that spark?
Absolutely. I got it on Friday afternoon, my last block. A group of students who are, they struggle. It's what's called an inclusion class, so it's students who perhaps the standard method of presenting material doesn't always work for them. And we had been working on something that I knew was a challenge, but I thought they were up to it, and they came through. And that's always an incredibly empowering feeling.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the biggest challenge that teachers face?
Well, there are so many. I'd say the biggest one is, and it touches somewhat on what Barbara said, is that there are times when you feel like you're out there on your own, and you're doing the best you can, and you're struggling with time management, behavior management, getting the curriculum out there, and so many things, so many balls in the air, as it were. And then something comes up, and you expect to get support, and you don't, either from parents, from administrators, from colleagues, and all of a sudden you sort of feel like you're floating without a lifeline. And that's very difficult.
Did you ever feel that in your previous career? You were selling telephones or
selling,
telephone systems?
Yes, telephone systems. Okay. It was a combination sort of a, you know, buy low, sell high brokerage house, but also dealing directly with customers. And being in management in a sort of a profit mode of business, as long as you're bringing profit into the company, you're doing your job. And there are any number of ways to do that. And certainly being in management, you can call the shots more often. Education isn't profit motivated. There are so many other variables going on, and a given person may be looking at your grading scale and how many of your students are failing. They may be looking at whether or not you've taught two novels in the first 2 months rather than one. Any number of things they might be looking at. And a parent is only looking at what their single child is doing. And all of these competing interests have an ability to affect you. And that's far more difficult than simply looking at a bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Chapman, is the solution here to get really thick skin if you have all these people that not necessarily on your side?
Gosh, I wish I knew what the solution was, because I agree that, as Kenneth said, there are a lot of competing interests here. I think the only thing close to a solution is knowing what the goal is and kind of keeping your eye on the goal. And once again, that's doing what's best for children. And it's corny and it's trite, but I think it's keeping in mind working with the whole child. And it's not just the academic aspect of the child, or it's also the social aspect of the child, the physical development aspect of the child. And when I say children, I'm thinking of all the children pre-K through 12th grade, who don't consider themselves children any longer, but are to me at my age. But I just think, having the long-term goal in mind of what it is we're to do, and I think it's about giving choices. It's not us making the choice for them, it's giving choices and just keeping our eye on that, and how we get there helps us deal with the tremendous pressures that Kenneth is describing.
On the state of things today, we're talking about teaching, why people go into the profession. With us are Barbara Chapman, who is a principal in Orange County, and Kenneth Dobbins, who is entering his third year as a teacher at West Johnston High School. Over the weekend, Mike Ward, who just stepped down as the state school superintendent, announced that there's going to be this new plan in North Carolina, and it's going to put what are described as the best teachers into classrooms with children who are performing under par. Who are not up to grade level. And the idea behind this is to reduce the racial achievement gap. What's your take on that approach, Kenneth Dobbins?
Well, I did read that. And certainly historically, I think what has happened is teachers who are trained, first of all, in Johnston County, you have to be trained to teach academically gifted children in order to get honors classes. And so once you've gone through that training and you have some seniority, you generally get your pick of the litter. So the experience tells you that, yes, some of the better, more experienced, more highly trained teachers are teaching those classes. And simply the other classes fall to those newer teachers. And I think that is a mistake. I applaud the initiative. I'm not sure the teachers are going to go along. And the kinds of incentives that he offered, I think he said $16,000 over 7 years. Not a tremendous amount of money when it's broken out. But at the same time, I do think that one of the things I've found in training, I did go through that AIG training, is the brain-based learning theories that you learn in order to teach the best students, that kind of education is good for all students. Mm-hmm. And in fact, sometimes you see far more dramatic results more quickly with struggling students because they haven't been exposed to those kinds of strategies in the past. So I think it would be wonderful. I'm not sure how those teachers are going to respond because it's a very different classroom.
And Barbara Chapman, I wonder if you would be expecting there to be resistance from parents, too, who might be expecting that their children who are doing well are going to end up with this teacher who has built up this reputation as being a good teacher, and then that teacher's pulled out of those classes and going to other ones.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that's one of the realities that we have to deal with in considering this kind of a plan. And I think that, you know, when I said keeping your eye on what the goal is and moving toward that, you have to understand that's going to be some of the resistance. But if your ultimate goal is to do the best you can for every child, then you develop that thick skin and you move toward that goal. And it can be done, but there have to be, from the central office, from the Department of Public Instruction and administrators at the building level, there has to be support for these teachers to make it appealing for the best teachers to go into those jobs.
You're listening to The State of Things, and we're talking today about teaching. What makes people choose to become teachers, and how do we define a good teacher? We're talking with Barbara Chapman, principal of New Hope Elementary School in Orange County, and Kenneth Dobbins, a teacher at West Johnston High School in Benson. And we will be getting to your calls, 1-877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. Happy Labor Day. We're talking today about teaching. Why do people become teachers? What makes them good teachers? And what your experience has been with teachers. We'd love to hear it. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. With us in the studio are Barbara Chapman, principal of New Hope Elementary School in Orange County, and Kenneth Dobbins, an English teacher at West Johnston High in Benson. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. And John is in Greenville. Hi there, John.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I work as a biologist here in North Carolina, and I decided this year to think about going into teaching high school. I've got a lot of field experience, and I thought as a high school biology teacher, I could go in through lateral entry and really help out in the class. So I went to the Teach 4NC website where you can apply online. I filled everything out, sent it out to three different counties locally where I live, and I never heard back from anyone, and I find that odd. Because I continuously hear about how, especially in high school, biology teachers are really needed right now.
Okay. Barbara Chapman, Kenneth Dobbins?
Well, I can tell you a couple of things. One is, I'm not having gone through the website, I don't know what the response there, but certainly I know that education as a rule is just, you know, drastically understaffed and underfunded, and somebody may just not have yet gotten around to processing your paperwork. Don't be discouraged. We certainly need people with experience. As someone who, although I didn't do lateral entry, I went through a certification program, but coming into a classroom with life experience, you can't imagine the currency that has with students. You've been out there, you've done things, you've seen things that a teacher who has really never done anything but teach has not perhaps yet seen, and they admire that. They also admire the idea of someone who has had an opportunity to do something else, coming into a classroom and wanting to share some of that with them. So I encourage you to keep the faith and keep trying.
Barbara Chapman.
Unfortunately, Kenneth is right that central offices and office staffs are woefully understaffed in public education, and someone may just not have gotten to your paperwork. However, you might make some calls to high school principals in your area and just leave your name and let them know of your interest. You might call the central office. You might write a follow-up letter. And I will also say, unfortunately, this is not the first time I've heard this from somebody who's interested in lateral entry. But please be patient with us.
Okay, good luck to you, John. We are talking today with Barbara Chapman and Kenneth Dobbins about teaching in North Carolina. Why do you think, both of you, that there is such a problem of retaining new teachers? The the percentage is 48%. Almost half of the teachers who start out as new teachers this year are likely to be gone within five years, leave the profession. Do you have any sense as to why it's so hard to retain people?
Well, I have a sense from what I've been through. I can tell you that there are skills that I came into the profession with because of my previous career that have been invaluable to me.
Such as?
Management, for one. Managing people, managing a classroom, managing parent contacts. To me, effectively, the education is my product. The students are my customers, and the parents ultimately are my customers as well. And so the ability to handle a disgruntled customer has come in very handy.
Your tongue a lot?
Well, yeah, and you also deflect their negative energy into something positive, always looking at where you're trying to get. They may not understand my goals as a teacher. They understand their goals as a parent. And as much as possible, taking that energy and getting them to see that our goals really are both the student, their child. And for a first-time teacher who's never been through that kind of an experience in another field, that can be very upsetting. And often it becomes an emotionally charged conversation where they completely lose sight of that they're both working for the same thing. So those kinds of skills were very important for me in my first few encounters with parents.
Well, it's a very generous description, but having been an avid reader of your first 2 years here, I think you've talked about instances where you may have sent a child out of the classroom because you had a line in the sand, another person who speaks, they're out.
Yes.
That girl was sent out, and you got a phone call from the parent within an hour or two. And they were not, it didn't seem like they were seeing eye to eye with you, as you've just described here, about what's in the best interest of the child.
Well, and truthfully, anytime you have disgruntled customers, you don't always get them to agree. And certainly that was one of those instances. And I don't know how I would have handled that without, in this case, my mentor, who came through. And ultimately, and it's sad to say, but ultimately the advice was, ignore her, she'll go away. On some level, I think when you have those kinds of contacts with parents, you know, there's an expression that mess flows downhill. And for a lot of the parents, we really are at the bottom of the heap. So when they've come home from a tough day and they hear from a child that the child's been mistreated at school, they don't ask for the details of why. They just go and sort of vent whatever's in their life onto whoever's further down the food chain than they are. I know when I was a student, if my teacher had called home and told my father that I had acted out in class and been sent out, I would have been the one in trouble, not the teacher. I think that has changed over time.
Well, Barbara Chapman, you've been at this for 40 years. When did that start? You start to see that change?
Well, I guess maybe during the time I was getting my doctorate at Carolina, because I started in 1975 and went back to public schools in 1981, and I saw a big difference over that 6-year period of time. I don't know exactly what precipitated the change, but there has been a change, and I do know that when I was in a school in an area that would periodically have high layoffs, that one of the things, and these were professionals who had two big cars and big house payments and companies would close down, I would have to, you know, talk with the teachers about, I know this really hurts and I know it doesn't make it any easier, but they come to school and yell at us because they know we won't hit back. They know we're safe. And, you know, once again, unfortunately, I think Kenneth is right about that. I don't think it's necessarily lack of respect for us, but people who are just very stressed. I see that as the biggest difference. Incredible stresses on families.
Also, you are public servants. And maybe some people emphasize the servant part
servants.
Of it.
Yes.
We'll go to Jack in Whitsitt. Hi there, Jack.
Oh, hello there.
Hi. Happy Labor Day to you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Just my thoughts, complaints, I guess, about the school system, probably within North Carolina, but certainly within my district here, seems to be towards homogenization of students. My wife, in particular, teach severely gifted students. And the program that she's in is de-emphasized. Because the school in which she teaches mainly houses low-achieving students. And the emphasis seems to be more by the principal on making sure that the lower achieving students are brought up to level, and the severely gifted students that are there are de-emphasized and not receiving the money or attention that they need from the principal or the supervisor.
Well, I'd like to put that situation to our guests here, and I'm wondering is this an aspect of No Child Left Behind? The children left behind, the emphasis has been on those who are not achieving very well.
I think that's part of it. I think it's also sort of a pendulum swing. There was a time, I think, when there was a strong focus on the most gifted students, and a lot of money went to programs to sort of turn out little geniuses. This would have been during the time when Cold War, when we're most concerned about our school and the kinds of students we're putting out. And then certainly one of the byproducts of No Child Left Behind now is a focus on the lower achievers. And by definition, when you put so much of your resources to that, and also you're sort of gauging your successes based on test scores for those students, the reality is those tests are not terribly challenging for high-achieving students. So the assumption is, well, if we just leave them alone, they'll probably do fine. Nothing could be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately you will get kind of a homogenization. The lowest achievers are going to come up, but those high achievers are probably going to come down a bit, and we'll find ourselves with a golden mean. It's remarkable to me that we even do that. You know, this is America, that's sort of the land where you go into the grocery store for laundry detergent. There are 27 different brands. Why should we think that we're going to turn out with one particular test, you know, do the best for all those different types of students? Ultimately, that kind of testing is a disservice to all students.
Barbara Chapman?
Well, Jack may be gratified to know that this is a concern all across North Carolina and all across the country, what is happening for our most gifted learners and whether or not they are, in fact, receiving the support and attention that they need to have. One of the things that we have learned when we look at test scores is that often the most gifted learners are not making as much progress as they should be making, possibly because, as Kenneth said, we have assumed that they can take care of themselves, or in many cases their parents are advantaged and their parents can provide them things that schools have to provide for other students. But it is an area of concern. It is not one of the subgroups for judging whether or not we make adequate yearly progress. But I do think that every teacher and every administrator in North Carolina that I know of is paying attention to this area and very concerned about it, and taking steps to see that we address the needs of these students.
If the ultimate product of and point of public education is to put people out into the world who are educated, I wonder what the impact of these tests and No Child Left Behind and maybe the de-emphasis on the kids who are advanced, what's the impact going to be like 10, 15 years from now? Do we know? Will they be any worse off than they might have been otherwise?
Will who be any
worse off? Those children who we're not paying attention to, and you're talking about the tests being not at such a high level because of that.
I'm familiar with, because I teach English and teach ninth grade English, that the end of course test in English 1. To achieve a passing grade on that test, you have to get 38% of the questions right. That's hardly a benchmark for success in, I think, most of the world.
Who came up with 30? I mean, I'm just trying to remember. I thought a passing grade was a C or D, and that was usually 60%.
And
right?
the truth is, where the numbers come from, first of all, I actually had occasion to sit in on a meeting in Johnston County, because there was a new test the previous year. They had adopted what are called the state norms. The state decides what is a passing grade, what is a grade a little bit above, and they use a regular grading scale. They call it 1, 2, 3, 4, but ultimately it's like A, B, C, D. And the county had a meeting where they were going to decide to adopt their numbers slightly above the state norm, because the norm wasn't felt to be challenging enough. Under the state norm, every single student in Johnston County passed. Now, I've been in classrooms with ninth grade English students, and I do my best to see that every student does well. But there were students who did not achieve the results required in my class. They had failing grades. And because the test itself was such a low measure of excellence, they were able to pass my class simply because they achieved a high score on a test that ultimately took sort of the control of the classroom out of my hands. I think that story goes on a lot. those tests largely, I think, are not as challenging as we'd like to have them be. But at the same time, no one wants to see vast numbers of students kept back. So the people who are setting those norms are kind of struggling in that netherworld of, we want this to be challenging, we want to support our teachers, but at the same time, we don't want to have, you know, masses of students who can't pass. It's a hard spot to be in, but that's where we find ourselves.
We're talking about teaching here in North Carolina today with Kenneth Dobbins, who is a high school English teacher at West Johnston High, and Barbara Chapman is with us. She is a principal in Orange County. And from Moore County, Paul is with us now. Hi there, hi, Paul.
How you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Make sure you can hear me. I'm on the cell phone. Great show. I appreciate y'all talking about this, because one thing I got to say is I want to kind of, I had one teacher when I was in junior high in Laurinburg, when I was about in my third or fourth grade, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, a mild thing of dyslexia. And I had to fight my way through school, you know, and when I got into high school, I really didn't think I was going to get out of high school because of, you know, my reading problems and everything I had. His name was Mr. Jones. He was my junior high shop teacher. And he kept pushing me on, said, you can do it. And I finally got through high school and everything. But now, what I do now is I'm a wildlife control agent, plus I'm a wildlife rehabilitator. And I kind of give back to the schools and to him for helping me so much, for showing kids and stuff that even though you may have some form of problem or whatever trying to get through school, it is possible to go through school and to learn to up to the best you can. And plus, like I said, when I bring wild animals in to the kids and stuff, let them see it, I always tell them that I had a problem, you know, and everything when I went through school, but look where I'm at now.
How is that received when you say that to them?
Oh, they love it. I mean, they absolutely, I don't know if they like more what I say or more what I bring in as far as the animals, you know, and stuff. I bring in hawks and owls and other types of stuff, snakes and everything else. Did you ever think of
going into teaching yourself?
Well, yes, but I don't think I can sit there. I don't think I had the nerve and the patience that the teachers have these days. Because I know we was rough back when I was a kid, you know, growing up. But I couldn't even imagine some of the stress, like some of your two guests was talking about, some of the stress with the parents and everything. And, no, I'd rather deal with a wildlife. They're a lot easier to deal with trying to deal with a bunch of, you know, students and parents and stuff. I can deal with snakes and alligators and stuff like that, but I don't think I can deal with them.
Okay.
I got all the respect in the world for them. That's why I just tell people, I said, and also I tell people is that, time you get out of school, just because you're out of school don't mean you got to quit learning. Because, see, there's always things you got to learn. I had to learn how to do what I'm doing as far as wildlife, you know. You really, like I say, you're never out of class, you know.
Okay. Well, Paul, thank you for your call, and happy Labor Day to you. Thanks again. I'm curious, Barbara Chapman and Kenneth Dobbins, what teacher influenced you? Barbara?
Well, I think Meg Chalice, one of my second grade teachers, was a major influence. I was the principal's daughter, so I got to ask her years later why she didn't make me do the phonics workbook. I could not do it. I just couldn't do it. My mother was from the panhandle of Florida. My dad was from New Mexico. We were living in California. I could not sound out those words. I just had a terrible time. And, you know, when they would say, what's the vowel here? I could hear three or four vowels. And so I asked Mrs. Chalice, once I was all grown up, why she didn't make me do that book. I was already teaching myself. And she said, well, you seem to be learning to read okay without it. Now, heaven forbid that I should suggest phonics is not important, but I think it was a real life lesson for me as a teacher that you need to look at what kids need and not just necessarily what's put out there in front of you to do, and the decision needs to be based on individual children. I want to tell you quickly, though, I can build anything thanks to my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Pentazos, who made sure that the girls had the same amount of time in the woodworking center that the boys did, too.
Kenneth Dobbins?
Well, I was a student, a reluctant student in school, and was very difficult on all my teachers. I was not one of those students who imagined someday he would definitely be teaching. In fact, I'm sure some of my former teachers, if they're listening, are kind of gleefully sniggering to themselves that I'm getting mine now. But one teacher in particular, Bob Bailey, was a high school history teacher, and it wasn't so much what he taught me about history as much as he really taught me a different way of thinking about the world. And some of what he taught me in terms of that I bring into my classroom every day, and so that's nice.
What was the different way of looking at the world?
Just broader view, the idea that you're not at the center of it, but you're really on the outskirts, and there's so much more out there to see, and that when you begin to look with kind of a broader, wider scope, you realize sort of counterintuitively not that you're less important, but in fact that you're equally important with all these other people, and that's something that I think we as a nation sometimes as a culture fail to teach our children, that we're really not at the center of it. We're really just a little piece.
Mm-hmm. It's part of the critical thinking that you have to teach, mm-hmm. right? Well, we're talking about teaching today, and if you want to join our conversation, our number's 1-877-962-9862. If you had a teacher who influenced you, or if you've thought about changing jobs to become a teacher, or if you're a teacher on this day off and have a moment, give us a call, 1-877-962-9862. We'll continue our conversation with Barbara Chapman, principal at New Hope Elementary School in Orange County, and Kenneth Dobbins, who is an English teacher at West Johnston High School in Benson. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk with a recent college graduate who will start his first day of teaching in the Philadelphia public school system tomorrow. All that just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we're talking about teaching today and why people choose to become teachers. We've been talking with Kenneth Dobbins, who is an English teacher at West Johnston High School in Benson. He is now in his third year of teaching there after switching from an earlier career. Barbara Chapman is with us, too. She's a principal at New Hope Elementary School in Orange County. And joining us now is Jason Langberg, who graduated from UNC Chapel Hill last May, and he is in Philadelphia today. He is part of Teach for America. That's a program that recruits recent college graduates to commit 2 years to teaching in a low-income rural or urban community. And tomorrow is Jason Langberg's first day on the job in the sixth grade at Ada H. Lewis Middle School in Philadelphia. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much.
So, are you nervous?
Yeah, you could say that. A little bit nervous. More anxious than nervous at this point.
Why did you decide to join Teach for America and go through with this program?
Well, specifically with Teach for America, I was really unsure of what I wanted to do when I entered college. I had five or six majors, so I went through a period of changing what I wanted to do and what career path I wanted to go into. And by the end, after some of the experiences I had while I was in college, I decided that education was the route for me. And I knew some people who graduated the year before me that had joined Teach for America and had wonderful things to say about it, about the training, about the experience, about the challenges involved. And I started looking into it. It came recommended from different professors, and I met with alumni, recruiters. It just sounded like the perfect opportunity to start making the changes that I wanted to see.
So what are you going to be teaching?
I'll be teaching sixth grade science and math.
Oh, okay. Do you think teaching has changed in any way since you were in sixth grade?
Yeah, it's definitely changed in a lot of ways. Again, like a number of people have talked about, it's become more testing-based. It's a lot more geared towards these standards. We have a scripted curriculum here in Philadelphia, so it's a lot more structured, I feel like, than it used to be, at least when I was in school.
Mm-hmm. So it's telling you what you have to teach in terms of science and math.
Right, yeah. Right.
So have you come up against anything yet where you think that some of what that curriculum has to offer may not be such a hot idea?
Yeah, I actually have some problems with the scripted curriculums and teaching to test, I do what I need to do, and there's definitely a lot of room for creativity. They do give you a scripted curriculum, as long as you get through the material. In the end, you're still presenting it the way you want to present it, and you're still the teacher, and you're still in charge of your classroom. And then there's always homework to work with. You can work with the kids after school, before school, so there's a lot of room to work with and around that curriculum that they give you.
Well, as you were talking here, Kenneth Dobbins was shaking his head yes, and I think that Barbara Chapman was too. I'm curious, Barbara Chapman, Kenneth Dobbins, is there any advice you could offer Jason as he starts out as a teacher tomorrow?
Well, One thing I think that's nice about the scripted curriculum is that it's sort of like going into a football game where you've already got the plays and you know in advance what you'll be doing. It gives you the freedom to work on those other issues that are going to come up as far as classroom management and time management, which in and of themselves are challenging enough. So I think that's kind of a benefit. That was sort of why I was nodding my head, as I think it's not that it's going to be easy, but that's nice to have in your pocket as you go in there that first day.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Chapman?
Well, I would agree with that. And I think that, Jason, what you've said about this is the framework and you have plenty of room to expand from that is the tack that the teachers and I have taken at my current school. There's certain things that are a part of the curriculum that we're obligated to teach, and we don't argue are good things to teach, but we want to do that as effectively and efficiently as possible and move on to the more creative, more expansive things. So I certainly applaud your heart, and I certainly applaud your effort, and I'm certainly glad you're there.
Well, thank you.
Well, Jason, do you plan to be a teacher for a number of years?
I do have a two-year commitment here, and in conjunction with the program, getting my master's in education from St. Joe's here in Philadelphia. To be honest, I'm not sure what I'm doing after my 2 years. It's honestly going to depend on how much I enjoy the experience and a number of other factors. I know no matter what I want to do that I want to work with educational inequities, because I really feel like that's our generation's civil rights battle.
Right, and the school that you're at is in an inner-city setting?
Yeah, it's in northern Philadelphia. And it's in a very low-income area. All of our students are considered economically challenged.
Okay. What's the first thing you're teaching tomorrow?
I've taken the advice of those around me, and the first thing I'm going to teach are the rules and the procedures. Because unless those are in place, chaos happens, and no one's going to learn anyway.
Well, lots of luck to you, Jason.
All right, thank you very much.
Jason Langberg will start teaching sixth grade tomorrow at Ada H. Lewis Middle School in Philadelphia. He's part of the Teach for America program. Jason graduated from UNC Chapel Hill this year. Let's go to the phones right now. Chris joins us from Greensboro. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
Greetings. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've been listening very intently because I am a teacher, and I have really enjoyed the comments that have been made, especially by Barbara, mentioning that the curriculum and teaching should be student-centered. I'm an eighth-grade teacher in Guilford County school system, and I teach algebra and science. And I think we have gotten into a situation where we are defining the curriculum by tests, by the end of grade testing and the end of curriculum testing. And what I've found, just to share a couple of things, is basically with my children having started, just begun teaching eighth grade last year, teaching algebra last year, so I found that my kids don't know how to do fractions, which is basically a skill that they should have by the time they're out of elementary school. So we're having to go back because the test is driving us toward higher skills that their facts are supposed to pick up, but they're not connecting these in the processes that they need to be able to really truly understand the curriculum that we would like for them to learn. So I've another example, too, with the test-driven curriculum, you have a test that's given to the students at the end of the year. They have questions, and they have multiple choice answers on those. So oftentimes, teachers teach them how to answer multiple choice questions, which means eliminate possibilities and make your best guess, rather than solving, in the case of algebra or math, solving equations and problems and coming up with an answer and making that your answer and seeing if it works. So I think there are a lot of things wrong with the test-driven curriculum. It's certainly not child-centered, and it certainly causes, I think, a lot of the problems that we've been discussing.
So what does that leave? Issues. What does that leave for you? Are you going to stay as a teacher?
Well, I'm debating that right now. I have been offered a position in business management, and I'm really considering doing that. I've been teaching for 14 years. I have worked with elementary, high school. I've worked in a wilderness program. Had a variety of experiences. I am AG certified and just got my math certification for middle school. I'm hearing impaired certified, so I've been teaching in a variety of venues. My greatest successes have been in more open environments where I could actually work with children and working on developing their processing skills, their creativity, and their imagination. I do a lot of coaching with Odyssey of the Mind. Last 2 years ago when I was in a different county, I'm working in elementary school. I actually quit my job halfway through the year. I was working in two different schools as an AG teacher. And I quit halfway through the year so that I could devote the second half of my year entirely to one school. So I really worked full-time but only got half pay. And that allowed me to take kids to Odyssey of the Mind, to take a group to space camp to do a lot of innovative things in the classroom and outside the classroom. We put on a school play, which I produced along with another teacher. And the kids really got so much out of that, and I stay in touch with those students even today. But you can't do that when you're just driven to do info, factoid, which is what you have to do if you're going to accomplish the end of grade test, the end of course test.
Well, I think, Chris, you're also bringing up another point in there, too, and you talked about the kids got a lot out of that, but you were working for half pay, I understand, and that can't sustain for very long.
No, actually, I got myself into some financial troubles by doing that. So when you drop down from what is not a very good pay in the first place to half of that, of course, but I did that gladly. And it's because I think not many teachers want to go to half pay, but I think most of us are willing to put up with less than what we really deserve because we love teaching, we love children. You don't get into this job because it's a job. You get into it because it's something that you really, it's heartfelt, you love it, you want to be with children, you want to see them grow.
Well, I have to thank you for your comments, and I would like to put this to Barbara and Kenneth here, because we've gotten this far in the hour, we really haven't talked about the pay that teachers get. And North Carolina ranks about 23rd, that's the middle third, if I get my fractions right, of the country in terms of pay. But I've heard this said before, people don't go into teaching for the money, but I have to wonder if part of that is why there is the problem in retaining teachers after 5 years.
First of all, Chris, I hope you stay in teaching. We need you. So if you're still listening out there, please stay. Well, one of the stressors that I've seen on teachers at my school is that many of the new teachers, younger teachers, newer to the profession, are working two jobs. And, the teaching is I was laughing with someone on the way in. If you didn't grow up in a teaching family, you don't know that it is not walking in with the kids in the morning and walking out with the kids in the afternoon. The teachers at my school are there often until 10 o'clock at night when the custodian closes down the building. They are always wanting to know if I'm going to be there on the weekend so that they can come in. They go, if they're not there late, they're going out with, they look like bag ladies or bag men. They walk out with bags of things every night, boxes. One of the teachers goes out with a flatbed every weekend of materials. The hours they put in are amazing. And on top of that, many of them are working second jobs, not so that they can drive Porsches. They're working second jobs so they can afford repairs on the old car that they already have, so that they can afford an apartment. Yes, I think the salary is a part of it. I don't think the salary is a determining factor on whether or not people go or stay. But as far as the stresses that drive people out of teaching, I think it is very definitely a factor. They can't always make a comfortable living.
Kenneth Dobbins?
It's true. Certainly, I didn't go into it thinking I was going to get rich, and I'd been at a job where I've had Christmas bonuses that were more than I make in a year now. And that is an astonishing adjustment. Mm. The other thing that's rather odd is listening to Barbara talk about teachers who are staying till 10 o'clock at night and going home with bags and bags. While that is certainly true, there are also teachers who do leave soon after the kids and don't take anything home and pull materials out that they've been teaching for the last several years in a row. And ultimately, they get the same paycheck that somebody who puts in all those extra hours gets. And that's also difficult because when you've got young people who are excited about the profession, willing to be creative, willing to go the extra mile, and then they see that while it makes a difference in their classroom, and that's certainly while they're there, when those bills come to be paid and they realize that it doesn't really impact their income, that they work that much harder, on some level you wonder, why isn't there some kind of merit system? This is something that's been bandied about for many years. How could it be done? I can't even say. It would be difficult. But the idea of merit pay on some level for educators, I think, has some. It's worth looking into because really it doesn't make any sense that somebody who is willing to go the extra mile and put all those extra hours into it can't see some kind of financial incentive. No, we're not in there to get rich, but pay the bills, yeah, that'd be nice.
But the problem so often with discussions about merit pay, if they're based on student test scores, is a terrifying one to teachers, because the kids who need us the most, then the ones who are struggling the most, not that they don't all need us, but the ones that are struggling the most, the one whose test scores may not be as good, that may perpetuate the problem of trying to get the most qualified teachers, the most experienced teachers, to work with the most at-risk or lower-achieving youngsters. We've talked about merit pay for years, but there just has not been a good solution to that. And I worry about it being tied to test score,
which is certainly one of the great fears. And certainly, giving tests more weight than they already have is a danger. Also, as you say, you're going to find teachers who are looking to get classes with the higher-achieving students. And certainly that would be a problem. At the same time, this is an idea that's been bandied about but hasn't really been, I think, given an opportunity. Could it work? I think it probably could. Are there ways to come up with some sort of algorithm where it's not just test scores, but even some level of observation and evaluation by professionals?
Do you find yourself in the minority among teachers calling for merit?
Yes, also in the minority when I don't understand the concept of tenure. I don't understand the concept of a teacher who has been there a period of time, basically earns the right to be there, barring some sort of mistake, professional, financial, personal. Once you're in with tenure, you're in. I don't think it encourages people to continue to be creative, continue to make the kinds of changes that would make a difference in the system. One of the first things that happened after I published that article in the paper was a guy who'd been there 37 years said, "You hit the nail right on the head. These problems have been here for 37 years. Well, what kind of a system has the same problems for 37 years but doesn't address them?"
Well, you have been writing this journal in the News and Observer for the past 2 years. It was serialized in the first year. And you wrote one thing in March of 2003, "The problems in education won't ever be solved unless we're willing to shine the light on them and commit to doing the dirty work required to make things better." What's the dirty work needed there?
Well, on some level, the dirty work is going to be taking people who have tenure, who've been in there, and who aren't really educating their kids. And you go into any classroom and ask the students, they know which teachers aren't working. They know which teachers throw an overhead up that they've seen, they've been doing for the last 5 years and surf the internet while they're sitting there. So part of it is going to be getting rid of some of the dead weight. And
but
that's
it's
what
so
I mean
hard to do,
work.
Isn't it, right now, if you have a shortage of teachers?
It's a difficult thing. And certainly part of the dirty work is also going to be, are we willing to actually look at people who aren't doing the job? And I mean this by management as well. One of the systems that education is basically built on is the way to make money is stay in place for as long as possible, get your years of service in, get your retirement, and get out. That doesn't breed creative thinkers. That doesn't breed innovative problem solvers. It breeds people who don't want to make waves. And what I've found from writing those things that I write is that I have a reputation as a wave maker. Do I have the answers? No, but I'm certainly willing to shine the flashlight in some unpleasant places.
Are you on the tenure track?
I wouldn't expect that, but who knows?
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us today. We've run out of time, but thank you both. Kenneth Dobbins, an English teacher in his third year at West Johnston High School in Benson. You may also have been reading his articles in the Raleigh News and Observer about his experiences there. And Barbara Chapman, principal at New Hope Elementary School in Orange County. Thank you both for being with us today. Happy Labor Day. And Jason Langbert, want to thank him. He graduated from UNC Chapel Hill last May. He begins teaching sixth grade tomorrow in the Philadelphia Public School System. If you have a comment about our program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Or if you've missed part of the show and want to hear all of it, you can check out our archives on the SOT page at wunc.org. The state of things is a labor of love, as they say. Stephanie Hirsch, Corey Princell, Dave DeWitt, and Susan Davis produce the show. Keith Weston directs it. Robin Copley is our technical director. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava. Thanks for listening.